Now, just before we look at chapter 8, which is a very interesting chapter, I want to give you the rest of chapter 7 and jump at the end of chapter 8 to show you the context. At the end of chapter 7, we only went up to verse 14 of chapter 7, but in the rest of the chapter, he talks about wisdom. And he ends this chapter with telling us there are serious limits to wisdom. Wisdom is important. It strengthens us. It protects us. But there are serious limits to human wisdom. Look at chapter 7, verse 23. I tested all this with wisdom, and I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. Verse 24. What has been is remote and exceedingly mysterious. Who can discover it? In other words, the enigmas of life and the puzzles of life. Now, he ends chapter 7. You have to get this to get chapter 8 now, which you'll find very interesting. He ends chapter 7 with a very down note. Look at the last verse. Behold, I have found only this, that God made man, or Adam, upright, but they, the human race, have sought out many devices. So, Solomon makes very clear throughout this book, we are sinful creatures. And because of our sin, it also hinders us from understanding the ways, the mysterious ways of God. Now look over at chapter 8, verse 16. When I gave my heart to know wisdom and to seek the task which has been done under heaven, even though one should never sleep day or night, and I saw every work of God, I concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun. Even though man should seek laboriously, he will not discover. And though the wise man should say, I know, he cannot discover. Discover what? The enigmas of life. The total comprehensive plan of God. That was chapter 3, verse 11. God puts within us a desire for eternity to understand the mysteries of life, but he also will not let us see the whole picture. Now, that makes some people mad. That makes some people feel cynical and skeptical. And we looked at them this morning, and those people will go through religious form, but they give themselves to the pursuit of material gain and wealth. That's what they pursue. And Solomon says that's nothing to pursue. Now, in chapter 8, which we are looking at, verses 1 to 15, here's the main point. The main point is this. Wisdom has limits, serious limits. Wisdom is good. Wisdom is needed. We'll see that later in the book. But you need to understand something. Wisdom will not answer all the puzzles of life. You just have to accept that God knows what he is doing and that he does not let you, as a creature, know the full scope of his plan. Now, the purpose for that we've discovered already. And what is it? To fear him. To take him very seriously and to remind ourselves he is God. He is the potter, and we are the clay. And the clay does not say to the potter, I don't like the scheme. I don't like you holding anything back on me. But remember Deuteronomy 29:29. The secret things belong to the Lord. We have true truth, but we don't have exhaustive truth. There's many mysteries yet to be solved when we get to heaven. Now, that's all that we are going to look at this evening, the limits of wisdom. The blessing of wisdom, but it's limited, and so we must submit ourselves to God. All right, now, let's just get into it, because I think you'll find what Solomon does here is very, very interesting. You have your outline in front of you, point number 3 on it, further limits to wisdom and wise men. And that was begun in chapter 7, which we did not get to. I just can't cover every verse in the book. You would all just die, and I already don't know how you put up with all this already that I'm giving you. If I had to listen to me 7 times, I'd be tired. Okay, verse 8. Chapter 8, verse 1. And I just want you to know I did not get my Sunday nap today. So I might be a little irritable, and I might just have to take a nap myself while I'm up here. Who is like the wise man? Now, he's going to say 3 things about the wise man. 3 things. First of all, who is like the wise man? And that's not really a question. It's really an exclamation point phrased in a question. When he says, who is like the wise man, he is saying something positive. He is saying that it's an exalted task, an exalted position. There is a prestige to it. And he's thinking of the actual sage. In the Old Testament, often the elders were considered the wise men. And he is saying that he respects the task, he honors the wise man who is like him. Now the second thing he says discusses the impossibility and the limits of the task. And who knows the interpretation of a matter? Well, the wise man. That's his task. Who understands the interpretation of the matter? There is a lot in wisdom that is very puzzling and enigmatic. And it's very frustrating at times. That's what he said in chapter 7. That's what he says at the end of chapter 8. Now, the third thing he says about wise men is this. A wise man's wisdom illumines him and causes his stern face to beam. Now, George, what translation are you using?
The King James.
Would you stand up and read verse 1 for us? I just want to hear this. So we're all talking about the same thing.
Okay.
Turn around, brother.
Who is as a wise man, and who knoweth the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom maketh his face to shine, and the boldness of his face shall be changed.
Okay, all right. Very similar. Who is like the wise man? That's his position. Who knows the interpretation of the matter? That's his task. And those are all good things. But the third thing is, a man's wisdom illumines him or makes his, and causes his stern face to beam. So, in other words, wisdom has very many beneficial and ennobling effects on us. Changes our appearance. Now, I don't want to get sidetracked, but let me just give you some examples from the seventh chapter we didn't look at. Wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers. Chapter 7, verse 19. Listen to this. Chapter 7, verse 12. Wisdom is protection. Chapter 7, verse 21 and 22. Also, do not take seriously the words which are spoken, lest you hear your servant cursing you. In other words, wisdom teaches you how to handle criticism. And then 7:16. Do not be exceedingly righteous, and do not be overly wise. In other words, don't be pompous, and don't be self-righteous, and don't think too much of yourself. Chapter 7, verse 18. The one who fears God comes forth with both balance, wisdom, peace, and answers. So in other words, in the seventh chapter, he said this. Wisdom has many wonderful beneficial effects. Many wonderful effects. But it's limited. That's what you have to understand. And it will not give you all of life's answers. Now, I like what he says here about the face. And this is a good exhortation for all of us, moms and dads and grandfathers and grandmothers and bosses. Someone has said, the face is the mirror of the soul. Proverbs 15:13 says, a happy heart makes the face cheerful. And you remember in Exodus 34, when Moses saw the Lord, his face simply was radiant. Psalm 34, verse 5, those who look to him are radiant. Their faces are never covered with shame. What he is saying is that wisdom will show on your face. Wisdom will give you an air. It will give you a spirit, a demeanor. What does your face look like? Is it angry all the time? Does it have a worried look on it? A sourpuss look, like you've been weaned on a pickle? Hostile look? An unhappy look? He says here in our text, a man's wisdom illumines him and causes his stern face to beam. The man who knows God and knows the truth of God, it should show on your face. You shouldn't be rattled at every problem. You shouldn't be a boss at work that's just yelling at everyone and going around like a big sourpuss. Moms and dads, how do you look at home? Dads, when you come home, do you look like an angry old guy? Everyone runs for cover? Mom, are you screaming and yelling at the kids all the time? They wonder if you're insane. Reminds me of one of our neighbors in New Jersey. This is true. This lady screamed and screamed all the time. We were three houses down. We could hear her. And one day, I'll never forget this, she comes racing out on the porch, and I can't do this or I will actually lose my voice. At the top of her voice, and she had a voice, she should have been an opera singer, screaming at the top of her voice, and we could hear this so clearly, "Don't make me scream!" I don't know what else they could have. That's what she did all day, just screaming and yelling. I used to think she must be a lunatic. What does your face look like? Does it look like a wise face? A trusting face? Peaceful face? Christ-like face? It's going to show. Maybe you ought to look in the mirror sometime. Don't get too scared. What does your face look like? What are you projecting to other people? What does your wife see? What does your husband see on your face? The face is a mirror of the soul. All right, these are the benefits of wisdom. He respects the wise man, but now he's going to go into his main subject. There are serious limits to wisdom. We have to remember that when we approach a great case. Now, let me explain the next few verses because they're really very beautiful, but you could miss something. This is an analogy. Solomon is a writer of Proverbs. He tells us in the 12th chapter that he collected many Proverbs. We know he wrote much of the book of Proverbs. What he says here is in proverbial, poetic, analogical language. Okay? So that's what he's using, an analogy. And he's using an analogy of a great Eastern monarch. Now, I must explain the difference between a monarch, an Eastern monarch, and today's king or queen, because you won't get the picture here. In the Near East, in the days that Solomon wrote, a king had almost godlike powers. They had all power. You know, we have the Queen of England, and personally, I feel very sorry for her. What the British press does to her, they ought to all be taken out and shot. They're just looking into everything she says, everything her children do, and they are constantly bombarding the newspaper every day. Almost every day, someone in the royal family is in the news, and, you know, they scratched their nose yesterday, or they got caught looking at someone else. And, of course, the whole thing with Prince Charles and Diana was just outrageously scandalous. And they can mock them, they can make fun of them, they can spoof them, and, you know, the Queen can't do a thing. Now, in our own country, we have a president, and people love to make fun of the president, and jokesters make fun of the president. They have jokes about the president. People just mock the president, etc. It doesn't matter who would be his president. They would do that. Now, that's what we're used to. That is not the context of the Near East in the ancient world. If you wrote in the newspaper, that old Solomon, that old Billy Goat, he looks like a Billy Goat, that would be the first and last thing you ever wrote. You'd be killed. Everyone say, okay, kill them. They had godlike powers. The monarch was more like God with his powers and his ability to remove any enemies. All right, now that you have to keep in mind. Now I want you also to keep something else in mind as you come to this passage. The Bible clearly teaches, and the Jews who read this knew this, God is a king and a great king. Psalm 47:2 says this, "For the Lord Most High is to be feared, a great king over the earth." He's to be feared. Don't mess with this king. Psalm 47:7, "For God is the king of all the earth." Psalm 95:3, "For the Lord is a great God and a great king above all gods." And we are told in the book of Revelation, Jesus Christ is King of kings and Lord of lords. He came the first time as the servant to be beaten up and crucified. They cursed him, they smacked him, and they killed him. But he's coming back on a white horse with armies of angels. King of kings, Lord of lords. A sword will proceed out of his mouth, and his enemies will be slain as the great king and monarch that he is. Absolute rule. The Antichrist, he just blows him away. Just the breath of his mouth. All right, do you have that in mind now? With that analogy, let's go to our text. Verse 2, and I believe I have this right in the notes here for you. The wise sage under an absolute monarch. Now, just before I go into the text, one more thing I need to tell you. The analogy includes the thought of a sage, a wise man, who is in the king's court. He's a courtier. So he reports to the king, and he gives advice to the king, counsel to the king. Now, do you have the mental picture here? Let's look at this. Number one in your outline, he must obey the king. 8:2. I say, keep the command of the king because of the oath before God. In other words, your oath to the king to obey the king. Keep the command of the king. In other words, you are to obey the king. You are to listen to the king. You are under oath. The confession of every Christian is Jesus is Lord. Now, you might not agree with the king. You might think the king's got a bad plan or the king hasn't explained the plan. That doesn't matter a bit. Doesn't matter one bit. Obey the king. Listen to the king. Very interesting story told of General Patton during World War II. He said the most important thing in being a general is picking good military leaders. When you go into battle, you want the right leaders at your side. You don't want to question what they will do. You want to know what they'll do. And so he had a little test, he said he used to do. He'd get a group of lieutenants and key men, and he'd say this, "Men behind warehouse 10, I want an 8 foot long, 3 foot wide, six inch trench dug by hand. Go do that." Well, these men would go out, and he would watch from a distance. And he'd hear one man say, "Well, this is silly, wasting our time digging with shovels. They ought to get power equipment." Others would say, "It's awful hot today. We should do this another day." Others would say, "Well, we're lieutenants. We shouldn't be doing this. Let them get grunts to do this." And they'd start complaining and arguing with one another. And finally, someone will say this, "What difference does it make what he wants to do with this trench? Let's dig it and get out of here." He says, "Those are the men I want in battle. I want men, when I say charge and go into battle, I'm not going to worry about whether, oh, it's awful cold in battle today, and those bullets are really coming quickly at us, and there's an awful lot of bullets coming at us." He says, "I want at my side the men that when I say go into battle, they will go into battle." Obey the king. As a Christian, as a wise man, because Christ has made us all wise, because he filled us with his Holy Spirit and given us word, we are to obey. That's the marching orders. Jesus said, "If you love me, you obey my commandments." So he says, that's the first job of the wise man, of the sage. Obey the king. Number two, don't argue with the king. Don't argue with the king. Look at verse 3. "Do not be in a hurry to leave him," the king. "Do not join in an evil matter, for he will do whatever he pleases." Do not be in a hurry to leave him. Now, what he is thinking about here is the sage, the wise man, in the king's presence, and maybe there's an argument. Or maybe the sage has a plan, and the king doesn't like the plan. The king has his own plan. The king's going to go his own way. You don't, in the presence of a king, get all hot and bothered and say, "I'm quitting. I'm out of here, man." You don't do that. And because if you do, it says here, do not join in an evil matter. Don't get together with the other servants and say, "I don't trust this king. This king doesn't know what he's doing. We're going to have to teach him a lesson. I'm quitting." He says, you do not argue with the king. Don't leave in anger. Don't leave in hastiness or in disagreement. Why? Because the king does what he pleases, and the subjects do what the king wants. Listen to what Isaiah 46:5, 10 and 11 say about our great king. "To whom would you liken me and make me equal and compare me? Declaring the end from the beginning, saying my purpose will be established." Listen carefully. "And I will accomplish all my good pleasure. Truly I have spoken. Truly I will bring it to pass. I have planned it. I will do it." When you're in the presence of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, you don't argue with him. We just saw that in the lesson this morning. You can't argue with one who is infinitely powerful, has all knowledge and all power. Who are you to even argue with such a one? Why? Because he does what he pleases. This is what we have to learn as subjects. God does what he pleases. It's his all-encompassing plan. He didn't ask us for the plan. He's not even asking your advice about the plan. You're too ignorant. You couldn't figure it out until you get to heaven. Don't argue with the king. Don't answer back to the king. Don't smart talk him. And yet how often, in many ways, we really question the king. Now this all is in the context of our book with dealing with the all-encompassing plan and sovereign control and wisdom of God over his universe and over his creatures, and we can't figure it all out, so we start arguing with him. "I don't like the way my life has turned out. I wish I was like that person. I wish I had that amount of money. I wish I had that kind of education. I wish I lived there. Why did you do this? Why did you do that? Why didn't this happen?" He will do as he pleases, and you have to learn that. Now, number three, the king's word is supreme. Look at this in verse 4. Since the word of the king is authoritative, who will say to him, what are you doing? This is a very, very big problem Americans have. It's all over. Americans have almost no sense of authority. This is the country of independent agents. Whatever you think is true. Truth is whatever you believe. There's no absolute truth. There's nothing above you. You're the standard of truth. And we live in a society of 250 individual atoms bouncing around. And there's very little respect for authority. You can see this in the Roman Catholic Church today. It's an amazing thing. The Roman Catholics have a pope. They have a teaching magisterium. There shouldn't be any argument over interpretation. And yet, millions of Catholics disagree with their own pope. They're completely inconsistent with their own belief. They do not believe the pope. They don't listen to the pope. And you go to Europe, it's even worse. They will have an outward affirmation of the pope, but in reality, they go by their own standards. And they just disagree. They want abortion, they have it. They want women priests, they have it. Doesn't matter what the pope and the teaching magisterium says. That's the whole mentality of modern man. There's very little respect for authority. Now, notice what our passage says. This king is authoritative. He's authoritative. And who can say to him, what are you doing? The sign of a born-again, obedient child of God is that God's word is authoritative. It's the king's word. And we don't say to him, I don't like your book. I don't like the way you're doing things. Why don't you change this? Tag Lindbaum, in an essay on modern democracy, writes these words. I know it's a little long, but try to listen. They're really powerful. Good description of modern man. Here is the question in modern democracy, he says. Who will rule, God or man? How do you like that for a beginning line in an essay on democracy? Who will rule, God or man? This is the great constitutional question of human existence. This is the question that determines everything in mortal life, and especially and most accurately in our social arrangements. What about questions of abortion? What about questions of women's rights? What about questions of greed? What about capital punishment? Who rules, God or man? The perennial question is always whether we humans are to understand our presence on this earth as vice, regency, or trusteeship under the mandate of heaven and divine commandments, or whether we must strive to emancipate ourselves from any higher dominion with human supremacy as the ultimate aim. So the question is, in democracy, who will rule? Who will rule? Who is authoritative, God or man? We have chosen already. Who is it? Man. I know. You were right, George. George, you were right from Christian perspective, but I meant society at large. So don't be mad at me. Society at large has already made the choice. We rule. We are supreme. Man is the measure of all things. J.I. Packer puts it well when he writes this. Undisguised contempt for restrictions and directions and turbulent defiance which bucks all systems when it's not busy exploiting them have become almost conventional, and everyone who respects authority stands out as odd. You look at the young people today. And then Chuck Swindoll, in his lucid style, writes this. Not even the president of our nation carries the clout he once did. Ours is a talk-back, fight-back, get-even society that is ready to resist and sue at the slightest provocation. Instead of the obedient Minuteman representing our nation's image, a new statue with a curled-up lip, an open mouth screaming obscenities, and both fists in the air better describe our times. Defiance, resistance, violence, retaliation are our new style. Obey the king. Obey the king. He is authoritative. And you don't ask him, what are you doing? Now that's in the context going all the way back to chapter 3. All things are beautiful in its time. You say, I don't understand that. It doesn't matter, friends. Obey the king. He knows what he's doing. When you get to heaven, you'll look back and say, oh, I should have obeyed the king. did I mess up? He's authoritative. He's supreme. You are not. You're only a servant. And I love what Luke says, and at that, we're not even profitable servants after we've done everything he told us to do. Supreme authority. And that supreme authority is communicated to us today in the Bible. The Bible is supreme authority. Every word is the word of God and from God. And we should listen to it and have an attitude of a servant under a great monarch and obey him. And even when we don't understand, obey. We must obey the king. Don't argue with the king. The king's word is supreme. Since the word of the king is authoritative, who will say to him, what are you doing? Now, number four in your outline, be safe, obey a royal command. Verse 5, he who keeps a royal command experiences no trouble. In other words, if you want to stay out of trouble in life, listen to the king. Listen to his word. Obey him. In other words, if you do what the king says, you'll probably prosper. You'll have the best chance of making it through life. If you don't obey the king, there's a good chance you could get killed. There's a good chance he'll resist you. And you know that's true in life. People who obey the word of God, well, they're not going to be getting drunk all day. They're not going to be going out and gambling their money. They're not going to be going out committing fornication. Why, if you disobey most of the commandments of the Lord, you'll just have a good, healthy life disobeying the Lord. So many of our problems are just because we're just flat out disobedient to the Lord. Think of, we were talking the other day about people who don't believe there's sin in the world, or man's basically good. Well, why do you think we are spending so much money on prisons today? Because man's basically good? Why do you think we're spending so much on FBI and all of our police? In fact, every major city says they need more police. How come they need more police if everyone's basically inherently good? Why do we have so many of our taxes going to the protection of our citizens because of all the evil in society? Because man is not basically good. Now, if you'll listen to the king and you'll obey the king, you'll stay out of a lot of trouble. You'll probably stay out of jail, and that's a good thing. And maybe you say, well, I'm not real happy in marriage. Obey the king, and you'll probably have a much happier marriage. Divorce won't settle anything to start the whole process over again. So if you obey the king, you'll avoid a lot of trouble. It's just common sense. If you sow good seed, you'll reap a good product, a good harvest. So stay out of trouble, obey the king, and you'll be happier. Now, he moves to a new section here. Same thing. See in your outline. The limits to understand... I just love this little section. This is one of my favorite little sections. Again, you have to see it as an analogy. There are limits to wisdom. So the best thing is just obey God. You don't have to solve everything. That's neat. I don't have to figure it all out. You lose your head. You lose your mind if you try to figure it all out anyway. I just obey the king. Follow the king and you'll stay out of a lot of trouble. It's really good advice. Accept your limits. Accept your place under the king. That's his job to take care of all the other details. See in your outline, the limits to understanding the right time and ways of the king. Verses 6 to 8. For there is a proper time and procedure for every delight when a man's trouble is heavy upon him. In other words, in hard times, there is a right procedure and a right time to address the king. Maybe you've got a legitimate thing to say to the king. Our king's a very much listening. He loves to listen to our prayers, doesn't he? And you can speak straight with our king. He doesn't mind. He's not afraid if you speak straight with him. He's not like a tyrant king. He's a righteous king and a just king and a patient king. So there is a proper time and procedure. Verse 7 is the key verse in this section. If no one knows what will happen, we don't know the future, who can tell him what will happen? In other words, we're humans and we can't predict the future, so we can't say what the future is going to be. We can't determine all these things. Again, the limit of human knowledge. We have great, serious limits to our knowledge. Human ignorance is his point here. Only God knows. Only the king knows. Now, verse 8 expands on verse 7, if no one knows what will happen. Look at verse 8. There's four little points he makes in verse 8 to show us the ignorance of each human and the limits to our knowledge and why it's just best to listen to the king. Four things in verse 8. No man has authority to resist the wind. These are illustrations now of verse 7. No man has authority to resist the wind. With all of our technology, we can't change the course of the wind. Now, I don't know about you, but if you want to do a picnic or you want to do something outside, there's nothing that will ruin your time like wind. Now, I have no idea what it's like in Tennessee, but in Colorado, we can get serious winds coming right down off the mountain. Serious winds ripped a tile off your roof. And in Boulder, they very common to get lots of big, heavy winds, up to 100 miles an hour, coming right down through the canyon there. Serious winds. Well, if you want to do anything outside, you can't do a thing. When it's windy, you just blow your picnic basket away. If you want to go fishing, just blow you over, knock you over in the water. We can't control the wind. We can't go out and say, now you win, you go that way. You go to that city. We have no control over the wind. That's how limited we are. God has control over the wind. Now, here's a second illustration, and it's much closer to home. Or authority over the day of death. What does your translation say, George? Verse 8, the second sentence. Have the power in the day of death. Have the power or authority in the day of death. Now, I can assure you, the most important decision you'd like to be involved in is in the day of your death, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you like to be able to talk to the Lord and say, now, Lord, I need about 30 more years. I want to accomplish all these things. You don't have a say in it. You have no authority over the day of your death. Now, who has authority over the day of your death? The king does. You don't. Our king does. You can't control the wind, and you can't even control one issue you would really, really like to control that's very dear to you, when you're going to die. Now, we have a sister in our assembly. She actually visits our assembly. She's not in it, but her children went, and they like to come and visit from time to time. They're in a different kind of church, and they like to come over and hear the Bible teaching occasionally. And this sister, back in November, her children were planning her funeral because she had only a few weeks to live. She had lung cancer, advanced lung cancer, and they called me up, and we're going to do the funeral, and what are we going to do? Should we have the food after or the food before? Should we all go to the graveside? And Mom was real good with accepting her death. Two of her children are medical doctors. They dealt with the very best doctors, and the doctor said, back in November, she will not make it to December. No way. No way. And the husband was very broken up. Well, what is it? September? She's up in the mountains hiking, doing pretty much everything she wants to do. Here the doctors had her in the tomb. They had her funeral planned back in November. The best that the doctors can do, and she's still alive. And she's actually doing well. She's not even on chemotherapy. The cancer went into complete remission. We don't have control over the day of death. We had a brother in one of the Colorado Springs assemblies, and he was supposed to die within 6 months, and he lived 11 years. So the doctors may pronounce you dead. That doesn't mean you're dead. I just want to assure you that. They may pronounce you in will good health, and you walk out and fall dead, or they may kill you on the operating table. You don't have authority over the day of your death. We have some pretty strong limits on us, don't we? We're not so smart. Now, there's a third one here. And again, these are illustrations to show you that we can't predict the future, and we have very little authority control over these issues of life. There is no discharge in the time of war. I don't know what your translation says, but what he's basically saying here, you can't get out of the battle. If you're in the army and there's a war going on, you can't even say, I'd like to go home for a rest. I'd like to have Mom's good apple pie. It's so cold and miserable on this battlefield, I'm just going to go home. You can't do that. You do that, you get shot. You know, the Israeli army is an amazing army. I don't know if you know anything about it. It was trained by the British. But in the Israeli army, because they knew they were surrounded by enemies and they would have plenty of wars, they had to create an army that would be different than our army. Now, in our army, when it's time for battle, the commander yells, "Charge!" And the poor soldiers have to run out into the bullets, right? And the commander's in the back, "Charge!" The Israelis knew they'd never win a war that way. So under the British and under their training, the lieutenant says, "Charge!" And he adds one more thing. Does anyone know what it is?
Follow me.
Follow me! The Israeli lost more lieutenants than any other group in the wars because the lieutenant leads the charge. And when he says charge, you have to follow him. Now, if you decide, you know, I really don't like this. It's dangerous. I'm running home. Because the lieutenant can yell charge and follow me, if you turn around and turn a tailcoat, you know what he can do? to shoot you on the spot. No one will ask any questions. If you do not follow him, he can shoot you. And he will be in his powers to do that. So what he's saying here is, you don't even have enough power to get out of a war once you're in a war. And then the last thing he says in verse 8, four things. And evil will not deliver those who practice it. In other words, the inescapable effects of sin upon the sinner. What you sow, you will reap. You take drugs, you probably wreck your body. You drink for years, it will do many terrible things to your body, but it will do terrible things to your personality and your psyche. The inescapable effects of sin upon the sinner. You can't even escape or be rescued from your own sin. You can have forgiveness, but you may very well be left with some terrible scars. The limits of understanding the right times and ways of the king. And he wants us to show us again how limited knowledge is and how limited wisdom is and how limited we are. So really, the best policy is obey the king. He has authority. Obey the king. Now, let's move a little quicker here because I see that you would all like to be released. It's been a very, very long day for all of us. Verses 9 to... You're ready? That is true. I cannot say that because I cannot get into each individual head. I cannot do that. Thank you, brother. But could I just say one thing to you, brother?
Yes.
The king says be quiet. I'm just joking. Just joking. Matt, did you invite him to camp?
He's son-in-law.
We'll talk to Kevin about that. Tell you, it's amazing who they led in camp today. Okay. All right, we'll have a mediated position. We'll go slow and fast. Verse 9 to 11, living with injustice and unfairness. Solomon keeps coming back to this because this is the annoying question to the all-encompassing plan of God. All this I have seen and applied my mind to every deed that has been done under the sun, wherein a man has exercised authority over another man to his hurt. Now, although we can't determine the day of our death, we can't determine the wind, we can't determine getting out of an army, people still exercise some measure of authority, and they usually do it to hurt one another. Now, here's an illustration of it in verse 10. So then, I have seen the wicked buried, those who used to go in and out from the holy place. They are soon forgotten in the city, where they did thus, this to its utility. Verse 10 can be called, in verse 11, be called the triumph of the wicked, or the absence of retribution. It's a big problem, Solomon says. It keeps coming up when we talk about a God who's in control of everything. There is still the triumph of the wicked. Now, it's very interesting what he says here. I have seen the wicked buried, and he means that in a good way, those who used to go in and out of the holy place. Here are wicked people, unfair people, crooks, and they have a wonderful burial. And they used to go in and out of the holy place. They used to rub shoulders with religious people, hobnob with political leaders. And they have this facade of being good and with good people, and yet they're wicked and they have a good burial. I don't know if you know this or not, but in the 1920s, before Al Capone was really exposed, Al Capone was actually considered a hero in the Chicago area. He was a Robin Hood. Students at Northwestern University, Medill School of Journalism, were asked to name the outstanding personages of the world. Al Capone was listed along with George Bernard Shaw, Mahatma Gandhi, and Albert Einstein. When Al Capone would go into a baseball game, they would stand and cheer him. Now, by 1931, however, the tide had changed, and the people booed him, and 6 years later, he was sent to Alcatraz, where he spent 8 years. When he was released from Alcatraz, he will illustrate a verse here, and I'll tell you the rest of the story when we get to that verse. I think of Colombia. I don't know if you watch the TV news and what is going on in Colombia. They are ripping that country to shreds. It's a beautiful country, actually. Just very recently, a church was raided, and half the congregation was kidnapped. They've released now some of the children and the women. Missionaries have been kidnapped and disappeared. Well, Pablo Escobar was the billionaire drug lord. He was basically a Robin Hood, cheered by the people. They hated it when the police finally killed him, but he was a bloody butcher. I think today in our own news, I read just weeks ago about Danny the Bull, John Gotti, the famous godfather who was in prison. His son was just in prison just the other day. But Danny the Bull squealed on John Gotti and got him in prison. Now, Danny the Bull has confessed to the FBI to killing, not personally, of course, professionally, 19 people. But he is completely free under government protection. Well, somehow they found out where he is, and they put it in the news. People have found out where he is. They put it in the newspaper, and he has become a hero. And people, when they see Danny the Bull, they go up to him and ask for an autograph. And he hobnobs with important people. And John Gotti hobnobbed with important people. The verse says, you see the wicked? They go in and out of holy places. You have the wicked, and they go to church, and they know the head of this organization, and their children christened, and the church blesses them, and they go out and shoot a whole bunch of people and steal a whole bunch of money. They're with the politicians, and they look like they're wonderful citizens. And he says, this is the triumph of the wicked. And you see it in our own society today. Now, at the end of verse 10, they are soon forgotten in the city where they did dust. That could either mean the wicked were forgotten in the sense of all their evil deeds were forgotten after they died, or it could mean the righteous who stood against them, they're forgotten. The point is, it's all futility, a lack of retribution. Verse 11 is a good verse for today. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. You know what this verse is saying? If you don't have immediate retribution, people are actually emboldened to sin more. Now, I don't know if you know the story of New York City with Mayor Giuliano, but 15 years ago, even as much as 10 years ago, people did not want to go to New York City. They were having 2,000 murders a year. Brother Pat would know this. The situation was desperate. If you went into Times Square, and when we were teenagers, that's where we would go, Times Square, 42nd Street, the Village, we would hang out there for do nothing else, just to watch people. It's the most interesting city in the entire United States. There's actually no comparable city in the United States to New York City. Manhattan. There is nothing comparable to it. I lived 3 years in Chicago. And you couldn't go on 42nd Street. I remember taking my wife on 42nd Street 10 or 15 years ago, and she was just scared. Well, Mayor Giuliano became the mayor, and one of his jobs was to clean up New York City. But he came in with a policy, a real clear policy, and it was called the broken window policy. Do any of you hear this policy or understand this policy? And he and the chief of police agreed on this policy. Here's the broken window policy. When people see a broken window in a building, what do they think? No one's caring for that building. No one's watching that building, and so that's where the drug people go, homeless go, crime is committed there. So, the broken window policy is this. When you have a broken window, what should you do right away? Immediately fix it. That tells people someone's watching the building, and the building's occupied. What Mayor Giuliano and the chief of police said is this. All crime counts. And up until this time, they said, we got to go after the drug lords. We're going after the murderers. We're going after the mob. And they were letting all this low crime go. Giuliano said, that hasn't worked. And so they started right down on the street with the guy who runs up and wants to clean your window and forces you to give you money. That's against the law. Arrest them. Get them out of the street. All the panhandlers just filling the streets. They just cleaned the streets out of them. And they put special police officers in Times Square dressed in a certain way that just were on those particular streets all the time. And they saw panhandlers, they saw people selling dope. In fact, I'll just say this quick story. This is a true story. My wife's here to validate it. I don't know how many years ago, but let's just say 20 years ago, my wife and I were in New York City, right on the corner of Times Square and the Americans. Avenue of the Americans. Just standing right there. And a man came out of the car, and a young man came out from behind a store, and they came out, traded money, traded drugs, and walked away. We watched the whole thing. Just stood there and just saw the whole thing. Five years later, we were on that same corner, same spot. The exact same man came out of the car because I knew his clothes as soon as I saw him. Came out, another young man came out, they traded, did the same trade, and walked off. We said, look at that, the exact same guy. We watched that drug transaction. Well, they have come right down on that. Now, here's the point. When there's retribution on crime on every level, New York City is considered a miracle story. If you go to New York City today and you walk around Manhattan, you feel a difference. 10 years ago, you could feel the oppression. They have cleaned the streets up. Why? Because there was retribution to crime. Can I say the same thing is true of the local church? you let sin get carried on and you let people do all these things and there's no church discipline, and I know church discipline is difficult. There is nothing more difficult. It'll rip your guts out of you. But when you let sin go, other people say, oh, well, they divorced and remarried. No one said a word about it. We can do the same. When there's no retribution and there's no judgment to sin, people are emboldened to sin. Look at verse 11. Because the sentence against evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men are given fully to do evil. When you live in a society and a man kills another man and he's 20 years on death row and then he doesn't even go on death row, I'll tell you what the criminals say. Don't worry about it. You're not going to be killed for that. Don't worry about it. You get a good lawyer, you'll get out of that. People are emboldened to sin if there's no retribution. So Solomon is saying this. When society is this way, people just sin more. The triumph of evil. It's injustice. Now, it's a good lesson for us. Like it or not, when a man kills a man, if there's swift and just judgment, it will teach people a lesson. There's always argument. Does it teach anyone something? Of course it teaches people something. Monkey see, monkey do. We're very teachable. And the same thing's true in the local church. One of the reasons we discipline is that all will fear. I know when we've had public discipline in the church, everyone sits there with their head down. You know, it could happen to any of us. It makes us fear, and it makes us know the judgment of God. So we are to have discipline. The same thing in your home. If you just allow the children go time and time again, you warn them and warn them and warn them and never do anything, after a while they know you're not going to do anything. So don't say anything. It's better not to say anything. They're given to do more evil. Now, verse 12 and 13. Look in your notes, E. There is hope of justice and fairness with God. Now, Solomon will go throughout this book and say things that are very dismal, and then immediately show you an answer. And here's an answer. Although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God and fear him openly. Now, I call this the triumph of the righteous. Triumph of the wicked, now triumph of the righteous. Solomon says this, I know, I don't guess, that those who fear him and those who do righteousness, they will be well. So that is a very positive answer to this whole question of justice and injustice. Verse 13. It will not be well for evil men. He will not lengthen his days like a shadow because he does not fear God. So verse 12 and 13 tells us the real answer. It doesn't go well with the wicked. They may be getting away with it, but not for long. Remember I tell you about Al Capone? Al Capone got away with it for a while. He was a hero. He was very wealthy. He defied the law. But he spent 8 years in Alcatraz. When he left Alcatraz, he had advanced syphilis, and he died a complete recluse and died in 1947. No friend, no hero, no parade. A complete recluse and a very ill and sick man. Look at what this verse says. But it will not be well for the evil man. He will not lengthen his days like a shadow because he does not fear God. My friends, the Bible tells us no one gets away with injustice. No one is getting away with it in the end. Verse 14 restates the whole problem of the injustice of the righteous man, the wicked man. He restates that. In verse 15 he says, I commend pleasure, for there is nothing good for man under the sun except to eat and to drink and to be merry. This will stand by him in his toil throughout the days of his life, which God has given to him under the sun. In other words, remember to enjoy the gifts God has given by loving all-wise God to those who fear him. Don't let the frustration with the big picture keep you from enjoying the present moment for those who fear God. Don't fight the king. Obey the king. Be under his authority. If you love me, Jesus said, obey my commandments. Do you want things to go well with you? Obey the king. God will have justice. Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the King of Kings and Lord of Lords who is Lord over our lives. We pray that we will really see that he does as he pleases, and that we really believe that he is authoritative. And we are not the ones to say, what are you doing? We are to obey. And when we obey, we avoid much trouble. Help us to see him as a great king and to obey him and not keep questioning him or be angry at him or cynical with him. May we love him And may we seize the good things you give us at this moment. And may we not be an ungrateful people. May we take the joys that you give us and the pleasures you give us, because they come from the hand of a good king who wants the best for his people. To these ends, we ask your help. Amen.